today's program. The songs that you heard are as follows. We started today's show off way back at 4 o'clock with Joan Baez. We heard Caleb Meyer from Dark Chords on a big guitar. Then it was Live Nirvana. We heard Where Did You Sleep Last Night from Unplugged in New York. Then it was Ozzy Osbourne going out to Matt. We heard Bark at the Moon from the Essential Ozzy Osbourne. Then it was Rye Cooter. Brand new music there from Rye Cooter. We heard The Prodigal Son from Prodigal Son. Going out to Jim, we heard Howlin' Wolf with Spoonful from the early years, remastered tracks. Then, for Mark Parento, it was The Police, Tea in the Sahara. That was a live rendition that was originally off of Synchronicity. Jonathan Richman for Charles Laquadera, we heard Vincent van Gogh from his record Not So Much to Be Loved as to Love. Going out to Bob Dylan and his Radio Hour, good old Bob Dylan radio theme hour, Bob Dylan. We heard P.F. Sloan's Halloween Mary from Where the Action Is. Living Color from Mike, we heard good old Cult of Personality. We then went on to hear Stevie Ray Vaughan, that was for David. We heard Life by the Drop from The Sky Is Crying. We heard a track from a local musician. His name is Bert Faulkner. We heard a track of his called In the Sun. Then it was The Hourglass, Down in the Texas from Dreams. It was the Allman Brothers before they became the Allman Brothers. It was The Hourglass. Then we heard Roxy Music give us The Strand from Live at the Orpheum. And it's been a treat to play all these songs. We're going to start our goodbyes. Pass it over to David. Say goodbye, David.
Goodbye, Bedford.
It's been real, ladies and gentlemen.
And Jim?
Hey, Vin. Good show. Good show, Vin.
Wunderbar. Thank you all for listening. Thank you for coming to the station. I really enjoyed it. Thomas the Vermonter is up next. He's with you from 5 o'clock all the way to 6 o'clock. Remember, the two most important days of your life are the day you were born and the day you find out the reason why. This is WMFO in Medford. There's Thomas the Vermonter. I'm out of here. Have a wonderful, wonderful Saturday. I'll see you next week at 4 o'clock. Take care, everybody. WMFO Medford.
I felt like Richard Dawson there. Show me crystal!
Good answer.
I was living in New York. I've been out here a few years. New York is, to me, like a very special place. Because everything is real important. Just getting a parking spot is important. All my friends would go to great extent to get one.
Hey, excuse me, pal. You can't park your car there. No, you gotta move your car. That's my friend's spot. See, he's gonna come around the corner here. He's gonna want to park in that spot. And, like, you know, if he sees your car there, he may eat your car, so... I suggested you move your car, you know, because, like, you don't got a sense of humor like I do. So, like, you know, I would really, truly appreciate it if you move your car, you see. And I don't say really, truly appreciate a lot because it hurts, right? So I suggested you move your car. I said, move your car, okay? Move your car. Who am I? I am the mayor of the block, okay? Just move your car. Look, officer, just move your car. My friend's coming around here.
For those of you who don't live here, we have a pedestrian walkway law, right? That is, if you're a pedestrian, you step in the street and traffic is coming, the cars have to stop, right? Now, that's a pretty nice law. I was not used to it. I'm from New York. If you're in the street, you're fair game. You know what I'm saying? Right? We go out of our way for people. Look, a back lady, get it! But out here, if you pull in a little bit over the white line, right, the pedestrians always get a little ticked off, and they always try to tell you what you did wrong. So let's say you're driving one big car, right? You pull in a little bit over the line. I want to show you what the pedestrian looks like, okay? So you're driving. Here it is. How many of you remember your first date? How many of you are having it? That many.
Oh, dear, Mr. Billy Crystal there, everybody. Billy Crystal, you're listening to 91.5 FM WMFO Medford. It is just a couple brief moments after 5 p.m., so that can only mean one very important thing, that this is Herd Mentality. So today in the studio, we have one Ms. Josie Watson here to talk with us a little bit about her expertise. So, Josie, welcome to Herd Mentality.
Thank you, Thomas. It's a pleasure to be here.
Oh, my pleasure. All right. So, I actually do. I have a flash news buzz for people in the greater Somerville area. There is a house fire on Teal Avenue. If you're planning to go near Teal Avenue at the moment, please don't. Because there is a hot mess. Everyone seems to be okay. Fire and first responders are on the scene, but don't go around there. There's a fire. And that is brought to you here first from WMFO. We get you the important hot news. Ooh.
Can I make an announcement too?
Sure.
So Somerville's Open Artist Creators Studio is having a week-long festival where all of their artisans are displaying their work. It's called Somerville Open Studios.
Okay.
And it's happening every day. And you can go every day to like work on a different project or meet the artists that like you've heard about, because Somerville artists are pretty big on the scene. So yeah, that's open all week and it's totally free and it looks really cool. I wish I could go. I can't. I have finals, but you guys should go.
All right. You heard it first. Somerville artists. Now's the time. All right. Well, Josie, you're a senior here at Tufts University, correct?
That's right.
All right. And the nature of your expertise is one in eco-pedagogy?
Yeah. So that's, I make that joke because that describes why I've bounced between every department at Tufts.
Okay.
I'm actually an environmental studies major. I decided to double in political science because we're required to double.
Really?
Mm-hmm.
You can't just be an environmental science major?
No, because there's a lot of flexibility in every environmental studies track. There mm-hmm. are four. You can go down the scientific route or the policy, food systems, and communications, like media studies of environmental awareness raising, etc.
Gotcha.
But in every track, you're pulling, you know, multiple classes from multiple departments.
All right. So needless to say.
Yeah. You don't develop a skill set.
Gotcha. All right. But you found your track. Mm-hmm. You found something that gripped you.
I did.
All right. So we'd love to hear about it.
Yeah. So, I mean, I say eco-pedagogy because it was this philosophical movement, essentially, that arose in the 80s.
Mm-hmm.
And it was sort of a mission to develop a robust appreciation for the collective potentials of humanity, to foster social justice throughout the world, with the idea that every component of human well-being is founded on access to environmental resources. And the first step that any of us have taken to structure a hierarchical society is to allocate access to resources along lines that we invented, class and race and gender.
Mm-hmm.
So there's a lot of intersectionality between environmental justice issues that involve, you know, your basics, access to food and water, and then the more complex issues, byproducts of a capitalist system like groups of people that pollution affect disproportionately in toxicity and stuff like that. Mm-hmm.
Gotcha.
So starting sophomore
year. Michigan still does not have clean water, everybody.
Yes, it doesn't. It's right. Absurd.
Yes, but please.
Yeah. Yeah. So once I realized that I wanted to study not ecology, not how, you know, animals and plants can live healthy lives, but the intersectionality between human lives and environmental quality. Hence, I wanted to get into the restructuring of human communities. I looked for a place to start that would still allow me to engage with what I was passionate about all while I was growing up, which is, you know, proximity to natural systems. Just the idea that human beings can reach their happiest and healthiest states only if they're surrounded by the natural systems in which we evolved. Eco-pedagogy also, you know, that's one of its major tenets.
Okay.
That's one of my favorite words. But yeah, so I decided I wanted to start with the, you know, strictly human environment that's also entirely natural, which is the food system.
Okay. So food system could be anything from agriculture to how we make decisions as to what we eat and where we get our food from, you know. All right, so the whole system there in its entirety.
Totally.
Great, okay.
Yeah, because if we are what we eat, then all of the components of distributing food and the food choices we make, all of the educational decisions that go into that and wealth disparity that, you know, causes us to develop different eating habits, they all... Like, all of those components are our biggest tethers to environmental systems still.
Right.
Something we engage with 3 times a day.
Right.
So if
at least.
Yeah. At least. Yeah. And so, right. Once you delve into that, you find it the field of food system analysis and study in terms of its constant human consequences only really started in the 90s.
Okay.
Like, even though... It was pretty clear that one of poverty's biggest results was malnourishment. Mm-hmm. You know, the poorest people in the world are going to have low access to food. We didn't have a very good understanding of nutrition, and there was absolutely no awareness of nutrition in like the 70s, 80s, and 90s, or at very least, you can say that the science is constantly changing.
Right.
And, you know, increasing in complexity.
You're saying I shouldn't just have Wonder Bread for each meal?
You know, scientists would say nowadays you should not have Wonder Bread as your only food, or like, I mean, we're starting to recognize that any human fabricated material that we put into food is going to have some sort of negative consequence on the human body.
Mm-hmm.
You know?
Okay.
Like, and we see, I think the biggest example of that is probably the obesity epidemic as it's related to adding corn syrup to our food as a sweetener.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Once you mess with food to, like, you know, increase your profit margin by improving the flavor profile of your food based on what human beings are instinctually inclined to eat, like, aka the sweetest and saltiest stuff,
right,
you're going to start messing up the functions of your body and destroying the health of people who don't know any better.
So for people who don't know, high fructose corn syrup is different from normal cane sugars that you might have other access to because of the ratio between the fructose and the glucose, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Awesome. So they're not, as sugar is not sugar, as some people might put it. There are subtleties as to the way your body will metabolize these things. Mm-hmm. And so between the two chemicals, it's important to have a different balance.
Yes.
All right, awesome. So one of the things we were talking about before the show, you were kind of talking about this idea of like unsustainable consumption.
Yes.
Okay.
So, right. And I guess that is related to this sugar dynamic that we're talking about. What is the reason that we're all okay with going down grocery store aisles, looking at products in plastic containers and rainbow neon colored labels? And looking at ingredient labels that have, you know, 60 plus ingredients in them sometimes.
Right.
Things we don't recognize.
Mm-hmm.
It's because we're living in a social system that is founded on abstraction.
Okay.
And this overarching theme of distance. between, you know, I like to say what's real in the world.
Okay.
Which I think of as, I think real and natural are kind of synonyms in my mind at this point.
Okay.
Like, what are other living entities on this planet? We're all codependent. Mm-hmm. And then there are products of the human intellect. We're very smart. We can invent a wide range of things and improve our lives through those innovations. But we also started to build these innovations before we fully understood the complexity of the living systems that we evolved from.
Right.
Like, before we understood our own body and mm-hmm. our own nutritional requirements. So, wait, we started engineering food. Of course, without the ability to conceptualize all the impacts that would have.
Right.
Right. Abstraction also ties into, yeah, one of my other favorite points, which is in a capitalist system, we assign a monetary value to everything we come into contact with.
Mm-hmm.
Whether that component is real or fabricated, real meaning natural or fabricated.
Okay.
Natural components come from highly complex systems, but the capitalist monetary mindset mm-hmm. leads us to think of natural resources as physical inputs that follow our logic. Like, right. if we put work into creating these, you know, physical inputs to our capitalist system by harvesting them, quote unquote, drawing them out of natural systems, we'll gain a profit from it. It's a very one-way logic that fails to consider that you're not drawing from one bottomless silo of physical entities. You're constantly interacting with a system.
Mm-hmm.
Every component that you engage with, that you take, that you use, it has impacts on manifold other things that, you know, a lot of ways we don't care about, right? Like, we can plow acres and acres of land, destroy hundreds upon thousands of species to plant corn,
mm-hmm.
put in our labor, put in our input,
right,
to grow all this corn that we'll harvest, sell for profit, use to feed our people, you know, put it in to get out positive human benefits without necessarily realizing that the other things we disrupt, the plants, the animals, they have roles like purifying the air, regenerating the soil that we need to grow the corn in the first place,
mm-hmm.
purifying the water that we drink. These are all, you know, like, a natural system is composed of those complexities.
Right.
And we depend on all of them.
So it sounds to me like, when considering the idea of, like, you know, an agriculture and a food system, mm-hmm. it starts in everybody's mind, right?
Yeah.
Our idea of what food is and what food can be,
yeah.
is entirely, you know, going, yeah. to influence the way we interact with these systems.
Yes.
Crazy.
Exactly.
All right. Well, let's take a quick break.
Okay.
We'll let that sink in. Let everybody, yeah. go out, have a bite of whole grain toast, and come on back.
Yes.
You're listening to Herd Mentality on WMFO. Welcome back. You're listening to Herd Mentality here I'm Thomas Keller, and I have Josie Watson in the studio today, and we are talking about agricultural and food systems, and we're going to talk about some of the very tangible ways you can influence your system at kind of a local and maybe even larger level.
Yeah, totally. Often the two intersect.
Great.
Yeah, so if you all were tuned into the first half of the talk, you heard me go on about food access, awareness of nutritional value, how all of those things are in, like, to an extent privilege, but they also impact something we depend on every day, which is the health, the vitality of our body and our minds. Mm-hmm. Like, I find it super interesting, studies that say the more sugar that you eat, the, like, that kills your focus, the greater chance you are of being ADHD, etc. And that applies to all other foods that have a high glycemic index, which, you know, more often than not are the highly processed grains and sugar that we find in, like, the cheapest American food staples, you know, things that are easiest to produce at a mass scale.
Sure.
And those, you know, these cheap foods are what are fueling America's lower classes and thus the brains of, you know, the children of these classes. Just, it's influencing their behavior and their capacity to learn and advance and climb the social ladder in classrooms every single day. The food that goes into our cafeterias or that these families can afford to buy for their kids has an impact on that. That was my personal reason for getting involved with food redistribution efforts in the U.S. So I don't know if any of you guys have come into contact with the massive discussions of food waste that have been going on. I think Letterman's talked about it. John Oliver definitely has.
Sure. I mean it's roughly, for somebody who has no idea, how much food do we waste, you know, in a country like America?
Yeah, so we waste, they say, a third of all of the food we produce gets thrown away without having any contact with humans.
So we don't even see it. We might as well have not have made it.
Yeah.
A third of our food.
A third of our
food. That people are plowing these fields and going through all this trouble to make is getting nowhere near somebody's mouth.
Yeah. You're talking natural resources. You're talking
water,
carbon emissions.
Yeah.
Like, just every component of that going into a landfill, creating even more carbon. You know, it's horrible.
Mm-hmm.
And, yeah, right. So we don't see a lot of that waste. A lot of it happens at the back of grocery stores very silently. Like, shelves are cleared and the products with, you know, more often than not, false expiration dates and labels are thrown away. These expiration dates are USDA mandates for food safety reasons, but usually an expiration date is required to indicate that a food should be thrown out like 2 weeks before it will actually become dangerous. So that on a mass scale is, you know, a huge part of the problem. And Harvard Law School is currently working on a huge lawsuit against the USDA to change its expiration date mandates, etc.
Sure.
Hoping that that will improve the problem.
That's great.
But while it still exists, it's a huge opportunity for enterprising young guerrilla warriors against capitalism who think socialism would be super cool. The component of socialism, like, that we're most focused on, is that everyone should be given access to food, to free food. We like the idea of giant communal dining halls in every town where excess ag products can be taken to this communal kitchen and cooked for everybody. At least, like, for dinner every day. We think that, well, me and my other food system specialist friends think that that would be one huge step towards greater quality. It would be fueling minds in the same way and helping us all attain the same level of intellectual capacity through, you know, proper nutrition.
And
So yeah, one way we can do that is by salvaging commodity foods from grocery stores that will be otherwise disposed of. The Tufts Food Rescue Collaborative started as a crafts house quirk, essentially, like, crafts residents of our arts and creative living commune house, the crafts house, started going to Trader Joe's in their cars, I think the year before I was a freshman, like 2013.
All right.
And every single night, someone found out that Trader Joe's dumpsters are filled to the brim, basically, with perfectly good packaged foods.
Wow. Okay.
Of, you know, just like a huge diversity of types of foods are all in this dumpster. Like every type of fruit and vegetable you can imagine, you're going to get hundreds in grocery stores that have bruises or slight damages in some way that make them unappealing. And so, they end up in the dumpster. Anything with an expiration date that's passed will end up in the dumpster. So Tufts Kids started cooking massive meals at the crafts house with their, you know, products of their salvaging journeys every single night, enough to feed, like 30 to 50 people. When I was a freshman, it was still huge because there were a lot of cooks living in crafts house.
Okay.
And so, then the people in charge of that graduated. I was the president of a club my sophomore year called Food for Thought. Okay. And we talked a lot about food waste during our discussions. And then when it came time for us to choose an action to fund, we decided to rent vans and do our own salvaging trips. We went to Trader Joe's, we went to Whole Foods, and found an unbelievable quantity of things. And so just like by coincidence, I ended up landing an internship through the Tisch College with a food rescue nonprofit in Boston. And I found out that they're actually nonprofits in a lot of progressive cities. Their entire mission is establishing relationships with grocery stores that will help them avoid food waste taxes.
Okay. So there's some incentive already to limit your amount of food waste if you're a producer, it sounds like.
Exactly. If you're in the more progressive cities, if you're in Boston, if you're in New York or anywhere in California, governments have found that their food banks have to spend less money on getting food if their grocery stores are supplying their food banks.
That makes perfect sense to me.
All of these little efficiencies.
Sure.
Low-hanging fruits.
Literally.
We save money, we improve human health. It's crazy. That's, you know, my favorite part of environmental studies is it's all so freaking easy.
Yeah.
You just have to get people together.
It sounds to me like, the hardest part of this is treating it like a holistic system.
Yeah.
Like, it's easy to get bogged down in one aspect of this. Like, oh, I want to, you know, impact the farming side, or I want to, bring food to people who are most at need.
Mm-hmm.
But if you are at the governmental level and you can see this bigger picture, it sounds like you're in a place to enact the most change.
Yes, you'd think so. I mean, that is why I chose political science, because while I understand, you can say that, right? There are all these components that you can observe that are interacting with each other. It's so easy to choose a pattern like food waste and start working on it. Well, to actually change food waste and have it start benefiting people, you need to have the know-how to start a nonprofit. Like the nonprofit I worked for is an operation of 20 people. You have to find funding for it. You have to establish relationships with your city government and then hopefully get state level funding. You have to communicate with the food bank. There are all these moving parts to actually implementing change that make it, you know, it can take 5 years for one operation to get going.
Sheesh.
And then what we really need to make it a viable solution to hunger and food waste, I mean, which is great, the incentives are there on both sides, are organizations like this in every single city in the U.S. And then you have to find like a group of engaged 20 people in every city in the U.S. Like, the reason that I chose to take the political science route is, I mean, what stimulated the formation of this was just a tax in Massachusetts.
Really?
So if you can, I have an econ minor as well, because economics is the language through which politicians speak and convince people.
Money talks.
Money talks, as they say. if it's as simple as a tax, as a policy, we have no excuse. Our generation has no excuse for not convincing our central bodies of power to be really taking a look at the inefficiencies of the system. Like, and food waste is a pretty obvious example of this.
Right.
And implementing solutions we already have. Like, Boston's a tried and true case study of the fact that Yeah, we're fund, like, one nonprofit is filling food banks in Arlington, Medford, Somerville, Cambridge, like, to their full capacity, mm-hmm. just with the excess of our grocery stores.
Wow.
Of course, we have one step further to go, which is educating the people that come to these food pantries how to eat properly, because mm-hmm. a lot of the wasted food from Trader Joe's especially is, like, jacked full of sugar, or it's just white bread.
Mm-hmm.
And so... just we shouldn't be supplying food pantries necessarily with that if it's going to negatively impact the heart health and the brain functions.
Right, we don't want to just be taking the lowest common denominator and yeah, passing that along.
Exactly.
We want to have some high quality yeah. produce moving through the system.
Yeah, but that's just me nitpicking. People don't like being hungry. They like sugar, so let's make them happy too. But yes, and right, and so then I've been doing macro level research, further expanding my understanding of the policy side of where these resources come from. Of course, it's easy as an environmental studies major to always get bogged down in the idea like, well, yes, it's good. We can work on improving the functions of society and human well-being.
Mm-hmm.
But our Earth is going to eject us in 30 years. Like, the strain that we're putting on soil and fresh water quantities is becoming more and more apparent, mm-hmm. especially as we lose control over predicting weather patterns.
Gotcha.
So increasing global temperatures or exacerbating global temperatures in already extreme or arid regions is going to render the rate of soil erosion
mm-hmm.
sort of, it's hard to comprehend how high it's going to be in 20 years.
Okay.
And, yeah, just through that same process of abstraction I was referencing earlier, the way that we farm now is very input-based. Like, we don't understand the ecologies of that used to regenerate soils.
So when you say input-based, you mean putting fertilizers mm-hmm. and things
yeah.
that are non, you know, organic in a lot of people's minds. So, like, nitrogen, phosphorus, these things that we're, you yeah. know, using to stimulate our soil.
Yeah.
Which might not be entirely productive.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That's a beautiful explanation and breakdown of it. It's sort of like the it's very simple analogy. The more caffeine you drink, the less effective caffeine is on your focus, the less sensitive you are to it.
Mm-hmm.
Same with a natural system. If you pump it full of the fertilizer inputs you were talking about
mm-hmm.
or the pesticide inputs you were talking about, then it starts... you break down that components of that system that did it naturally.
Right.
You get rid of them.
Are you telling us this Earth was here before we were?
It kind of was.
Oh my goodness. This just in, everybody. Oh my goodness. Human beings did not create the world around us. Oh my God.
Right?
Have we some humility to yeah. learn from this?
Oh, I mean, like, Thomas and I are looking out the window at a piece of land that, like, every piece of it was shaped and engineered by a human mind.
Yeah.
Like, the placement of every tree, the grass itself, the quality of the soil is just a factor of how much Tufts landscapers have pumped into it, all the chemicals in it. I mean, it's crazy how, you know, little contact we have with the natural world, the way it actually works these mm-hmm. days,
yeah.
like, or at least, you know, in an urban setting.
Right.
And considering what something like 60% of the world is projected to live in urban settings
yeah.
in the next 20 years, like, we're just going to continue to lose that knowledge. And yeah, it was here before us. And like, it was self-sustaining and had all of these complexities that made it, you know, self-sustaining. And a question that often crosses my mind is, like, how many of those components have we already destroyed?
Yeah.
And so, well, you know, scientists have that on lockdown. Like, we haven't destroyed them all. Ecosystems regenerate really, really quickly.
Mm-hmm.
I've been studying regenerative agriculture for a couple months now. And the premise of that is, yes, we've been pumping the land full of chemical inputs, fertilizers, and pesticides in a way that's actually increasing the rate of soil erosion. But if we just stop doing that, plants, you know, they won't be able to grow because the soils are naturally devoid of resources.
Mm-hmm.
But Then if you look, hopefully, if not next door in our agricultural breadbasket, Midwestern states, like, there's very little land that's in its natural state. Mm-hmm. But if you go travel elsewhere to a different country where there's unused land, you can look at the soil quality there and all of the species that are impacting it there, all of the plants and animals that exist on, you know, patches of land with healthy soil are the direct contributors to the health of that soil. Like, every single plant species has a relationship with the nutrients and the physical composition of the soils. They're drawing different nutrients from it and secreting different nutrients into it. Right. Same with the animals, but they're mostly just secreting nutrients into it mm-hmm. in a beautiful way. And so, right, you can take a look at those relationships and then go back to your exhausted plot of land that has been used for agriculture for 30 years and just introduce species. We call them cover crops that will secrete the right nutrients into the land. Or you can use integrated livestock management, bring animals onto the land, let them graze it for about a year. This component of the science is so confusing, like why we didn't figure this out 40 years ago, because it's so freaking obvious. It's just like, it's just, well, if your land is exhausted, let it go back to the way it was.
Right.
That made it fertile. That let you use it. Right. It's cyclical. Everything's cyclical.
So it's okay. So it sounds to me like okay. So we've gotten we started pretty big. We've zoomed in here. We mm-hmm. talked about kind of local food systems that can work, and now we're kind of zooming back out. And it seems to me like everything that's kind of wrong with the way we're treating these agricultural systems is that we're treating them in a static way. We're not really seeing them mm-hmm. as living systems. And it's like, if 100 exactly. acres are covered in corn, then corn's going to do really well there for X amount of time. But after a while, corn's eating everything corn wants.
Yes.
Okay. And then you got a bunch of corn husks lying around. What do you do with the corn husk? What do you do, you know?
Exactly.
You bring somebody who loves corn husks, he's going to turn that place around. All right. So if anybody would like to find a new breed of corn husk loving vertebrates, please let us know. WMFO, top of Curtis Hall. All right. We're going to take one quick last break, and we'll bring it all home. We are back. You are listening still to Herd Mentality here on WMFO. So we've been talking. I have Josie Watson in the studio here with me. We've been talking about how to approach, to look at, and to hopefully solve some of these issues with our food and agricultural systems and understanding how these systems all interrelate. And Josie, you were talking during the break about kind of this necessity for like an organic agricultural revolution, which sounds extreme, but when you think, we've been talking about the scale of how these problems have been evolving, mm-hmm. and if we don't make serious changes, we can't expect sustainable agriculture to continue in the future.
Yeah, I got on that based on the idea that we can focus on feeding more people until we run out of food altogether.
Okay.
Yeah, and so then on to that greater question of, you know, how do we make food systems sustainable? Like, we here on the ground level have no reason to fear. I don't think there are international, intergovernmental agencies like the United Nations that have a primary goal, just like their entire existence is dedicated to goals of perpetuating human life.
Would you like to list some of them for people who are less in the know?
The goals?
No, some of these groups.
Oh, the groups?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because anybody wants to hit the Google machine, you know?
Yeah, let's do it. I mean, all right. So if you're wondering who's working on feeding people indefinitely for the rest of our, you know, the universe's existence, you got the United Nations Food and Agriculture Organization, FAO.
Okay.
You have the United Nations Convention to Combat Desertification. They focus on avoiding soil erosion, the primary goal of that. That's the UNCCD.
All right, UNCCD.
Mm-hmm. Is so that global soils can continue to produce food for humanity.
Aha. Sounds good to me.
There's also the WFP, the World Food Program. Mm-hmm. They're more focused on directly feeding people during periods of starvation by airdropping food.
Airdropping food, that's exciting.
Yeah, like into crisis zones. yeah.
Necessary, all right.
Yeah, right? Doesn't that sound fun?
Sounds glamorous.
Yeah, I had an aunt who worked there once. She said it's a really cool place to work.
They made a wonderful movie about that, but, you know, it was about a very dystopian world, and I think the food was mostly pre-cooked when it fell from the sky. That's a different story.
Oh, no.
Yeah, I think it was cloudy with a chance of something. Who knows?
Oh, my God.
Sorry, I am distracting. All right, so, okay, so one thing people might say, okay, so one of the reasons we use these pesticides and we use, you know, genetic modification is to make our production more efficient so we can scale it up, right?
Intensify it.
Right. So how, okay, so we need something to offset. If we can't develop this, you know, production side things, how do we still get enough food for everyone? And it sounds like one of the big solutions is just cutting out the waste.
Yes. Okay. Yeah, love that. In the developing world, eliminate the waste. Mm-hmm. And then work on our trade policy.
Okay.
Which, you know, the concept of comparative advantage in economics, which is that every economy has products that it can produce the most efficiently.
Okay.
And so, like,
Antarctica has ice cubes.
Yes.
We have.
Yes.
R&B. Who knows?
Yeah.
The awesome.
U.S. R&B. So, right, the U.S. should hypothetically be producing R&B, and Antarctica should hypothetically be producing ice cubes.
Love it.
And exporting them.
Okay.
But, you know, and just like every African country in the world has the capacity to produce different types of grains, and South American countries would be better producing fruit, etc. Their soils, their ecosystems can handle it. They have the capacity to do that sustainably.
Gotcha.
And the U.S. should be producing like whatever the hell California and Vermont can produce. And all the other states should just chill the fuck out. Oops.
All right. So cheese and wine and maybe some maple syrup. Wonderful.
Yes. And then essentially we care about our farming economy and our farmers. They have a huge lobby. So they lobby us to continue to support and fund commodity crops that Africa should be producing, like soybeans and corn, et cetera, through subsidies. So, yeah, at the end of the day, we're going to end up exhausting our ecosystems, and Africa is, like, failing to find a market for a lot of their products. And I think, yeah, studies show that if we reformed our subsidies to the crops we produce and instead imported from Africa, that would be enough to lift 50% of African countries out of poverty entirely.
Wow.
Just like, yeah, get their economies going. And I'm not going to get into the fact that in order for the global economy to be sustainable, we need to focus on global distribution of resources and consumption patterns in a way that they all equalize.
Gotcha.
And then we can be in a system that, you know, we could more easily regulate and understand what needs to be regulated and how, etc.
Gotcha.
But this is way too broad. So.
All right. Yeah. Well, we've talked through, I think, way more than anybody expected to hear.
Yeah.
On,
yeah,
you know, their chill Saturday afternoon.
Yeah.
Let's see. If anybody wants to jump in, throw their hat in the ring. You can appeal to, let's start at the top. We got the UN. We got the UNFAO, the UNCCD, the WFP. These people are all, you know, influential on the global scale. You bring it down.
Yeah.
Maybe get in touch with your local state, city governments.
Yeah.
See what they're doing.
You can, I mean, if you have the dollars to spend and you're interested in engaging with food system reform, I know most people jump towards veganism, vegetarianism as like ways, or buying organic products as ways that you feel like you can influence the food system with your dollar. I recommend that you get educated. Understand that soil quality is actually dependent on the relationship between soils and livestock. So vegans are not doing much to restore soil health globally. Instead, you should, you know, try and spend your money on grass-fed animal products. I know they're way more expensive, but it's actually healthier for you to eat less meat. And if you're spending, you know, money on meat once a month, you can afford to spend a little more. And hence, you can afford to support the farming revolution, which ideally would regenerate soils by embracing natural relationships, like between cows and grass. And yeah, that's something really direct you can do. You can support your local farmers. You can, I know everyone says it, it's 100% true, because, you know, the smaller the farm scale, the more sensitive those farms have to be to ecosystem dynamics. And so by supporting that, like, it really is 100% more sustainable. No doubt about that. And yeah, if you're looking for something more wide scale, lobby local governments to support local farmers in any way that they can, and subsidize their price to make them more affordable on a wide scale on a local level, because we can't instigate widespread change by only engaging the highest socioeconomic classes. I mean, those are two very simple things you can do.
I hope everybody has learned a lot more about food policy than they started out with earlier today, and they feel like they have some modest but effective tools for really, you know, tackling this problem, because it's one that we all have a vested interest in. I think we all, at the end of the day, want to eat, and we want to not have people, you know, going hungry. All right, well, Josie, thank you so much for coming in onto the show. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. I hope I made some coherent points and
absolutely
didn't just ramble abstractly. Thank you guys for listening.
It was wonderful. All right, so if you're sticking around, we have some tunes to play to ease you into the rest of your afternoon. It won't just be, you know, environmental policy talk. So thank you so much for listening. This has been Herd Mentality with me, Thomas Keller, 91.5 FM, WMFO Medford, Tufts, Freeform Radio. just heard. That was the freshest track of the freshest album from Middle Kids. That's their latest album called Lost Friends that came out yesterday. So do check that out. That was Middle Kids. And just I'd like to reiterate something we talked about earlier in the show. That's the Somerville Open Studios. So once again, that's going on right now. Today, tomorrow, if you want to hear more about it, go to somervilleopenstudios.org. There's just so much going on in this town right now. There's, what are they saying? Over 350 artists. So do get out if you're in the Somerville community and check out and support some good local art. It's just great stuff, guys. All right. Thank you again for listening. We'll round out the hour with a couple more tracks. If you want to see Middle Kids, do look up. They're playing Brighton Music Hall right here in Boston on June 5th. So first week in June, you can expect to see them coming into town. All right, we'll cruise on out with a little more music. Another track off that wonderful album. So we're just about rounding up here, rounding out the hour on Herd Mentality. I got one more for you guys before I hand it over to Songs from the Squid Pod here with the wonderful Savoir Faire. So thank you so much for listening. Thanks again to Josie for coming on the show. I hope everybody learned a little thing or two. So thank you for listening. It's been 91.5 FM, WMFO Medford, Tufts Freeform Radio.